it's normal to feel like this. I think with confidence, you have to get to the point of acceptance. It has to be your first port of call. And so it is normal that from time to time you get knocks, and that affects your confidence. It knocks your confidence. So I think understanding where this comes from is really important.
Hello and welcome to the Building Better Leaders podcast, brought to you by Scaffold Coaching. I'm Rachel Sullivan.
And I'm John Tattersall.
Hello and welcome to episode number 11. Today we're going to be talking about confidence. Why do we sometimes feel that we lose confidence? It has to be one of the most popular coaching topics for improvement. When we're doing any coaching intervention, a lot of the time people come along and say, I've lost my confidence, I'm not as confident as I used to be, or I'm just not a confident person. So we're going to unpick that a little bit today. And I came to this the other day because I was listening to a podcast by a lady called Marisa Peer. And she can be found at marisapeer.com. That's MarisaPeer.com. And her mantra, if you like, is that you are enough. And she came to this by thinking that lots and lots of people think that they're not enough. It starts when you're very little back at school. And I know from my own personal experience, it was the see me's that you'd get in red ink from your teacher because your spelling test got 2 out of 20. And you start this whole idea that you're not enough, you're not good enough. And actually, instead of concentrating on getting the spellings right, you just don't want to get it wrong. And for me, that was where I come to think to myself, is that sometimes why I struggle with confidence? So look her up on the web because she's really, really interesting. If you want to know more about being enough. Anyway, we're going to get on and talk about three leadership essentials on confidence, and later in the coaching approach, we're going to also look at where our fictional character John is feeling that he needs more confidence. So, just before we get into the leadership essentials, for you out there, just sort of give a measure of how confident you are. When people come along and say, oh, I'm not really very confident, I need more confidence with you, I always say to them, look, the first thing to think about is that you are confident at some things. You know, I guess for all you people who've driven to work this morning, you can't probably tell me how many times you depressed the clutch, but you did it, and you did it unconsciously, and so you're quite confident to drive. You can, if I asked you to tie your laces and you did them, you tied your laces blindfolded, you could do it. You're quite confident at doing that. But when people start thinking about confidence, it's all about, it's an all or nothing thing. It's like, oh, I just don't have confidence. And in actual fact, you do. So we're going to unpick a little bit of that this morning. So here are your first leadership essential on building better confidence. Leadership essential number one. It's normal to feel like this. I'm going to say that again. It's normal to feel like this. I think with confidence, you have to get to the point of acceptance. It has to be your first port of call. And so it is normal that from time to time, you know, life can be hard and you get knocks, and that affects your confidence. It knocks your confidence. So I think understanding where this comes from is really important. So this is leadership essential number one. It is normal to feel like this. And it really is basically what you've been telling yourself all your life. And we don't know, I think, a lot of the time that we're doing this, but we do. So Rachel, what did your mum drum into you?
So before I talk about my mum and what she drummed into me, I'm going to rewind back about to a time when I didn't feel very confident, because I am somebody that, you know, it's interesting, John, when you share about you not feeling very confident at the beginning. I've always found I feel like I'm quite a confident person.
Yeah, yeah,
but
sure.
When I really reflect on it, it's because of what my mum used to say to me. But I wasn't always like this. I was a very unconfident child, especially in primary school. And I think it was probably because of a few reasons. But the main one was I was from a very small village in Doncaster. Because I was from this like very small farming village, we only had maybe 10 or 11 children in each year. So as a result, as a primary school student, and because I was born in May, so I was one of the youngest in the class, for 3 of the 5 years that I was in primary school, I was kept down a year. So every other year they used to split the year group. So the oldest would go into the class above and the youngest would go into the class below. And so I think that kind of, you know, just reflecting on it, it creates this feeling of not really being belonging anyway, because you're not with your year group and you know you should be a year group because you're in reception class together. And this, you know, this did happen, like I said, for 3 of the 5 years. And as a result as well, I guess, developmentally, because I was kept back for 3 years, I didn't progress as fast as friends did. And I don't know if those of you listening remember the Peak Book Maths, for example. I always remember, you know, comparing myself to this one other friend in particular. She's always like 2 Peak Book Maths books ahead of me. And yeah, I just, as a result, was very shy. I wasn't very good at reading. I was always in the special group. It's funny how they say special group for spelling. And children are mean, you know, it's not called the special group. It's called the thick group. And how does that come about even that young? I don't know. But then I went on to middle school, and you know, it was quite a safe environment in primary school. But in middle school, things did change, and all of a sudden, you're with other children from all the different schools. And it became very apparent to me at that time when I was in middle school that we didn't have a lot of money. My dad had made the very brave decision when I was in primary school to go back to university. So there was a period where I was on free school dinners, and things were very, very difficult. But when I do reflect back on my childhood, there were these real moments of memories of not having any money, been really quite poor, and then there'd been money, and then there'd not been money, and then there'd been money, and then there'd not been money. And when you are comparing yourself to other people and they've got the best trainers and the best jeans, we just didn't have any of that. There was 4 of us. My mum had 4 children under 5 years of age. And you know, that must have just been such a tremendous strain on them. At middle school, I didn't know I couldn't see very well. I just knew I couldn't see the blackboard. But you don't want to draw attention to yourself, because at that time, you just did what the teacher said and you weren't allowed to answer back. And so I used to copy off the person that I sit next to who... And so I used to get all my spellings wrong again. And then this label of being a bit thick sticks and not very good at reading.
But it's interesting what you tell yourself, isn't it? Even at such a young age. And, you know, on that basis,
I get frightened about spelling.
Like,
people that know me now that read my emails will be absolutely pissing their pants because I can't spell for toffee. And Microsoft Word and auto spell checker is my absolute friend. But when you can't even spell the word well enough that Microsoft can even work out what you're trying to spell, that is my level of spelling. And it's because I couldn't see. I think I was about 10 or 11. And they realised I just couldn't see, and I was incredibly short-sighted and I needed glasses. So as it transpired, when I went to high school, I caught up very quick, and almost, as they term it, a late bloomer. But yeah, for that period of time, I was very, very unconfident, or shy, as it was termed back then. But all this meant that by the time I was probably about 11 or 12, I didn't feel like I was enough. And at this point, my mum had also gone back to uni. She, you know, from Doncaster, dad was a miner, grew up in a pit village. So, you know, education really was seen as a freedom, I guess. And I noticed that my mum really changed when she went to uni herself. And I think she went to uni when she was about 40. She had 4 kids under 5. So it's quite a stress in itself. And then when my little sister was five, she went back to uni. And at this point, you know, I guess this coincided with me being a teenager, and my mum really saying to me and drilling into me, you can do anything. That, and it was such an impressionable age, and you know, don't worry about what they're doing. And my mum was actually training to be a teacher. It was really funny how my dad's mantra was never let school interrupt with your education. Like, and he was a teacher, like after he'd gone back to uni, he was like, never let school interrupt with your education. And my mum's was like, the teachers aren't always right. And I remember my mum having to really fight for me to be in set one for maths, because they were like, no, you're not bright enough. As it turned out, fast forward 4 years, I got an A star in maths and got the highest result of the year. But if my mum hadn't fought for me and fought constantly saying, you are enough, don't listen to them, you know, let it bat off you. And I used to come home and say, oh, my teacher said this and my teacher said that. And my mum would be like, why are you listening? And as it turned out, I was certainly a handful at school. I don't think there's many people that have been on report and yet walked away from school with like 7 A stars and 4 A's. And, you know, I'm incredibly proud of my academic achievements. But my predicted grades were B's and C's. No teacher expected me to do well, because it wasn't about what they thought of me. It was about what I knew what I could do. But that was my mum breaking it down all the time and really drilling into me at a really impressionable age that it doesn't matter if you can't spell. Who cares if you can't spell? What can you do? You're exceptional at maths. You can do this. You have a great head for creativity. What about history? What are you interested in? And really storytelling and so yeah, you know, I do think about my mum a lot, really. You know, she passed away when I was 17, but she left she really did leave that legacy that was, don't listen to other people, you are enough.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah. That's wonderful. So I mean, it's a wonderful story, really. So ask yourself, what have you been telling yourself? You know, every word that you say, it creates a blueprint in your mind. Yeah. And your mind's not bothered. It's not bothered what you tell it, whether it's good or bad. But it does tend to react to whatever you tell yourself.
It really does. And I think it's really catching yourself, because whenever I think, oh, I can't do this, or I can't think that, I just think, oh, my mum would say you can. You can do anything.
Yeah.
And I don't let myself, I guess, even now, you know, nearly 40, I don't let myself spiral like that, because I'm like, you know you can. But I also wonder if that's dealing with grief and death, that, you know, if you can pick your son up after that young, it's what you do when you are down and you are not confident and how you react to things. And I think it's what you said about the driving to work and the tying your shoelaces. We're all confident at living because you do it every day, right? Yeah. So you can do it. It's just the inner dialogue of how you tell the stories you tell yourself. That is essentially what confidence is.
Yeah. So ask yourself, what have I done today that makes me feel good enough, and get your confidence from that.
And you can tell I've been very vulnerable just then, because my accent went super, super Yorkshire. Leadership essential number 2 is stop comparing yourself to everyone else, or indeed people that you perceive to be more confident than you, or just a confident person. It's really about thinking about this. It's like an assumption game. You know, you think that you know everything about somebody, him or her, from what you've seen from them, or what you've heard about them, or what you've observed about them. But the truth is, we don't know about anything that's going on in anybody else's head, or how they see themselves. We make an assumption based on what we see. I spoke earlier about, you know, how I used to compare myself a lot to people all the time. And this was definitely something I did until I learned the science behind it. But the thing about comparing yourself to other people is that you have absolutely no idea about how that other person thinks they behave, and that they might not understand that how they come across to other people. They might think they don't come across as confident at all, and you're seeing them as super confident. You don't know their story. You very rarely know other people's life journey, and you very rarely know the intricacies of their inner dialogue, day to day, minute to minute, hour to hour. And I think the real thing about comparing yourself to others is it is a limiting belief, because if you are comparing yourself to others, you're always going to find somebody that's better than you. But that's just not how the world is. It's not how people are. So when we do start to play this game and you step it up a bit, you might infer something to support your already mistaken belief, and then you find, we look for evidence then. When we have a belief that's self-limiting, we look for evidence to support that already limiting belief. So when you see somebody that's more confident than you, you will only look for the things that demonstrate that they are more confident than you. And we see this a lot in celebrity culture all the time. You know, really, really tragically sad passing of Caroline Flack. You would have looked at her and thought she was such a confident human being. And it's just frightening to think about what was actually going on in her head and how unconfident she was.
Well, I mean, how many people would have said to themselves, I really wish I was like Caroline Flack?
Absolutely. And how sad it was to just hear how beautiful she was after, if only she could have heard that from herself. And I think that's it, we just make these assumptions, and you think, well, she's so confident, she can handle it, but people, you just don't know, do you? You never know. So really, you know, if you are somebody that compares yourself to other people, do check, you know, your self-limiting beliefs, and check where you're looking for evidence to support these, because unfortunately, as human beings, that's what we look for. We look for the negative because it's what keeps us safe. You know, historically, it is what has kept us safe, but that perhaps isn't the right mental capacity that we need for flourishing today.
So, as you say, Rachel, that leads on nicely to leadership essential number 3, and that is start recording all the good things. And you do have to write these things down. You know, coaching, we can help give you the ideas, we can help give you the tips, but you do have to do the work. And so, in the same way, write down those achievements, however small you think that they are. And whilst we're saying don't compare yourself with other people, do look at what the good people are doing. And what is really useful is to record what you want to achieve specifically. If you think about what your achievements are, you can look for the gap to where you want to be, and you can fill that gap. Just adopt a curious mindset. Find out how those people did that. Who did they talk to? How did they tackle it? So that's leadership essential number 3. Start recording all the good things, and specifically look to see what you can learn when you think about how other people are behaving. Good leaders can spot other good leaders' leadership skills.
Curious to know how a coach would approach this? Stay with us for the Scaffold Coaching Approach.
In today's coaching approach, we're going to revisit our fictional character, John, who we haven't seen or heard of for a few episodes, because we've been dealing with Janet and her leadership journey. But just to recap on where we left John. So in episode 4, we looked at motivation and John's fear of failure and his shared fear of suffering that he shared with Janet as his demotivators, and we started to see there that being well liked really matters to John. And we then picked up John's journey again in episode number 6, where we looked at how is John managing remotely, and the issue that John is facing now as a leader is post-COVID-19. He's really struggling with this concept of managing remotely. But as always, you know, found episode 6 and that coaching engagement useful. But as always, as we find in coaching, the problem that he's come to coaching with is not the root cause of John's issues. Now, since episode 6, he has been working on how he is managing remotely. When we start to dig deeper a few coaching sessions later, and this is where we pick John up today, we're really starting to see that John is having a crisis of confidence. Now, John has worked at the organisation for 10 years, so it works for John. He's very comfortable in how the organisation was, and he's well-liked. He's got really good relationships with his clients. He's a little bit of a maverick. We talked in episode 4 how he's known as a little bit difficult at times, and episode 1 when we talk about leading through change. And, you know, John has his ways of doing things, but that's because he's comfortable in his environment. Now, what working remotely and COVID-19 has done is it's thrown John out of his comfort zone.
So John, of course, is not really feeling as if this is normal. He doesn't really understand and want to accept that he is feeling a little bit down in his confidence. So what is it that we can do as a coach to help him work that through? What sort of questions do we need to ask him, Rachel?
So, you know, we start by, you know, we talked about ways that, you know, he could managing remotely in episode 6. But actually, when he's been putting some of those into practice, we ask him to talk through what is going on for him now. And he thought initially that why he was struggling with the managing remotely was because he was an introvert and it's not the routine that he normally likes. And he feels very uncomfortable with a team of quite a lot of extroverts in these big teams and Zoom meetings. And so we ask him as a coach to just talk us through what is going on. And of course, John, like most people, talks about behaviours, about what's happening for him, about how he just doesn't feel comfortable and he just feels like he can't get his mojo back, and he's associating a lot of it, and he keeps coming back to this being introvert. I just feel like I'm by
he's
myself a bit too much.
He's labelled himself
as that. And he's talking about behaviours and how he can't motivate himself back to the motivation about to jump on the big team meetings and things like that. But what we do as a coach is say, well, John, stop. You're talking about what you're doing. Talk us through now. What are you saying to yourself? Now, this is quite a different notion for John to get his head around. He's, what do you mean? What am I saying to myself? And so the coach says to John, well, what is the conversation you are having with yourself in your head before you're going on one of these big team Zoom meetings where you're having to be seen as the centre of attention? And he's very reluctant to do this, and he starts slowly, almost a bit ashamed, really, of saying, well, I just don't really feel like I'm at my best. Right. Can you elaborate on that? Well, I feel like I'm going to mess up. I feel like everybody's looking at me. I feel like they think I don't know what I'm doing. What else might you be saying to yourself, John? And he starts to, you know, a few minutes in, he starts to really use some quite visceral language where he's like, I'm going to mess this up. They don't like me. I look an idiot. I look fat on screen. I don't come across very well. I'm going to fluff my lines. I'm like, John, have you got lines? Well, no, I've not got lines, but, you know, I'm just going to fluff up what I'm saying. You're like, but you wouldn't do that face to face. He's like, no, but I feel confident face to face. And herein is where we start to unpick it. He is self-sabotaging and just almost like throwing darts at himself in his own performance, isn't he, John? And this inner dialogue is very mean to himself. And he's comparing himself constantly to Janet and the other leaders. And he compares himself massively to his boss, their CEO, who is an exceptional public speaker. He's an extrovert. He's very comfortable, been in the limelight. He comes across exceptionally well. And John is constantly comparing himself to him, and actually even to Janet, because she's always putting her hand up and volunteering for stuff. And John just doesn't feel like by the time he's got himself confident enough to speak, the agenda item's already moved on.
And it is really interesting. He is throwing himself so many negative thoughts, and it's a bit like when we were talking earlier in the intro as to how many times you tell yourself that these things are, you're not enough, you're not good enough. They almost start to, you start to behave in that way.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't, I mean, John has got 2 teenage boys. He'd be absolutely mortified, wouldn't he, if he thought that his children were doing the same thing as he's doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when we talk to John as a coach, we try to get to the bottom of where he gets this from. And it turns out that it was conversations with his dad when he was a bit younger around, you don't cry, you're a man, you don't show your feelings, be confident, do this, do that. That sort of do it instruction.
Pull yourself together.
Yeah, that really, really isn't helpful. But that's the language and they're the darts that he's thrown himself. And it is crazy how many darts we're prepared to throw at ourselves versus we wouldn't accept somebody else doing that to us.
And what we really start to see here, and we make links, is John had a very masculine type role model in his dad, you know, very as of that generation, the 1950s dad of been uber alpha male. Men don't cry, you go out and earn the money, you don't complain, you just get on with your job, you do your best and you provide for your family. But really, he's looking at his dad through childlike eyes, because of course he never saw his dad behind closed doors. He never saw the intimate moments between his mum and dad where there may have been vulnerability there, or the worry that you couldn't pay the bills, or his dad in the pub and the concerns with his mates. He's putting all this association and assumption behind even his relationship with his dad through the eyes of a child, which is what we all do. And we never see our parents as they really are. We see them as us as children and them as our caregiver and provider, and that's a generational thing. So as he is comparing himself now to his dad back then, and that's his inner dialogue of, you know, get on with it, man up, pull yourself together. Well, his dad isn't around anymore, so he can't even ask that and explore that vulnerability. He's just got these memories and these pulled together memories that are only formed at moments of intense fear, upset, because you only ever remember the emotional times as children, don't you? You remember the highs and you remember the lows, as such is life. And this is what we start to see with John, and it really does. All this is fascinating in coaching conversations because it all interlinks. And this crisis of confidence is massively interlinking with his fear of failure.
So one of the things that we ask him to keep a note of is how many times he's making assumptions, and will he go and test those assumptions to actually think, is this really happening? And often when people find this little key to having a look inside themselves as to what they're actually thinking, they start to really understand what's going on. And this, we hope, as a coach, will help him with his confidence.
Definitely. So in the coaching conversation, John seemingly seems a little bit all over the place in what he's talking about and his experiences and what's going through his mind. But this isn't all over the place at all. Often coaching provides the only option, the only time really as adults we get to put all of our thoughts and feelings and what's going on in our head out in an open space. And he's finding it's quite cathartic really. And when the coach probes a little bit, particularly around on the comparing, because he talks about how he's comparing himself to his boss and he talks about how he compares himself to Janet. But when the coach really investigates, well, where does this comparison come from and why are you comparing stuff, yourself to others, is that John's got these fears around, you know, fear of failure, but also a fear of suffering. And this comparison really brings him back, and what it's really sparking with him in this remote working situation is been left out, and are his team liking him, and he associates not been liked with not been good enough and with been left out and not in this inner clique is failure and has not been confident. And when we probe about where did this come from, John discloses that his mum and dad were both doctors, very successful in their careers, and their dreams were for their two children, John as a sibling, a younger brother, their dreams for their children were to be doctors as well. And he was brought up in a household. You work very hard, you try very hard, you're very academic. And the definition of success is to become a doctor. And John just didn't share this passion, but was forced, and we say forced, and encouraged, massively encouraged, to become a doctor. And his mum and dad measured his success academically as a child of whether or not he was good enough for med school. And therein was the comparison of his mum and dad's own high standards for him. But for John, when he reflects as well, he sees his brother as the golden child. His brother is a practicing medic today, working towards being a consultant. And his mum, who is still alive, you know, he does feel that she favours his younger brother slightly, and that he just feels that he went to med school. John dropped out in his final year of med school, which his mum and dad just could not get their head round. That.
And there's another reinforcing belief.
You're not good enough. Wasn't good enough, didn't get his degree.
For sure.
He left university without a degree. It's a constant dinner table joke for all of his 20s that all that wasted education, you've not even got a degree. His brother is going all the way. And this is the comparison, you know, this inner dialogue of not been enough.
So when we probe a little bit deeper as a coach asking some fairly incisive questions, we start asking him about, it was a really brave decision to leave university, particularly when you had parents that were so keen on you following their footsteps, if you like. What is it about that decision that you felt you had to make? Why did you not sort of toe the party line? And we see this often with his team, is he's very, very quick to jump to his team's defence because he believes so strongly in the way that he actually works, and he believes in his team so much that he's the first to jump and help them.
He loves an underdog, John, doesn't he? And this is where we see his kind of maverick sense of personality and almost that little bit of a troublemaker, because he's been through this experience and he's not towed the party line.
Absolutely.
He plays to this rebellious line.
And that's where we get to with him. We start asking him, how is it that he was able to do that? And we start getting him to list all the things that he's really, really excelled at. You know, he's got some massive accounts in this business. Everybody looks to John for the way that he behaves with clients, the way that he treats them, the way that he looks after his team.
So the coach gets John to do a really, really useful exercise. And if you haven't ever done this exercise, I would implore you to do it. Grab yourself a big piece of A3, or if you've got a whiteboard at home, grab yourself a whiteboard. And the coach basically gives John the pen and says, I want you to write everything you've ever achieved that you are super proud of in your life on this whiteboard. And John starts to talk through his achievements. And he actually, during this conversation, starts to look at leaving university without the degree as something he's incredibly proud of. And he always has been with his friends, but he can't seem to get that narrative straight with his mum and his brother, can he? But he's like, no, actually, I knew if I got that degree, I would go and do medicine. He's like, I knew I'd just do it for a year, and then it'd be so much harder to leave, and then it'd be so much harder to leave. And he's, I just knew it wasn't for me. So we're like, put it on the board, John, put it on the board. So he writes up as an achievement, not having a degree.
And I think one of the things that he probably doesn't realise that he's doing at the time is that he's actually promoting his interests. The job that he does now, he really loves. He is interested in it. He comes to work. Actually, when he's in flow, he doesn't feel as if, you know, the day takes that long, because he really enjoys his job. And the thing that we would ask you to think about is, are you following your interests, or are you more bothered about your position? Are you more bothered about your title? When John thinks back to how his mum and dad were wanting him to do well, and they just wanted him to do well, but they could only see it in their own sort of paradigm of medicine is that that was what they equated to doing well.
The title of being a doctor.
And it was the title, it was the position and the things that that brought you. But actually what John did when he left university with a year to go is he followed his own interests. And when he starts to unpick that, he really starts to see that actually, like we said right at the beginning of this podcast, you know, you're sometimes not confident in a dip, but it doesn't mean to say that you're not confident about everything.
Yeah. And when we probe him on this, we say, well, when else have you felt confident? And it's like, oh, well, I did a gap year. I travelled out, went to live in Sydney for a year with some guy friends. And he felt really, you know, how confident must you be to go to, you know, because you feel incredibly vulnerable when you go and live on the other side of the world with a backpack for the first time. He's like, yeah, no, I felt confident then. So like, write it on the board, John. He writes that on the board. I met my wife. I was confident enough to propose. I knew she was the one. I made the decision in his early, you know, in his mid-20s. He made that decision. His two boys, he's incredibly proud of that. He's incredibly proud of his sailing. You know, he has this incredible passion for doing these boat races and to be out in the sea along the elements, and he trusts his instinct. And obviously there's a lot of skill that comes with sailing. And his work, it gives him a lot of satisfaction. But what he learns from this is he has got the confidence, he's just not feeling confident at managing remotely at the minute. And therein lies where we start to build. We start to break down where he's not confident, and by following these three leadership essentials, he's able to focus in different ways to build his confidence back up.
So we hope that you found that really useful today. Confidence, as I said right at the very beginning of this podcast, it is probably the number one conversation that we have when people want to improve themselves. So we'll come back to this subject again with John, our fictional character. But that is feeling more confident for today. If you've really enjoyed listening to this podcast, please do come back and leave us some feedback. Be nice if you please.
we want to increase our confidence.
Yeah. And if you want to look at any of the other work that we do, please do follow us on the web at scaffoldcoaching.com.
See you next week. Thanks for listening.
Bye now.
Thank you for listening to the Building Better Leaders podcast. We hope you found today's leadership essentials and coaching discussion points useful. If you'd like to read more about the approach we take, check out our website at scaffoldcoaching.com.